I've chosen as a theme today, Suffering and Death, Central America. Continuing our overall theme of learning from Latin America, however, today we are obliged to look at a very dark side in Latin America. There are many elements for hope. Latin Americans, as I said to you the first day, a people of hope, maintaining that hope is the last thing to die. And I suppose hope is also an element in the tragedy which is taking place before our eyes in Central America. I have never visited Central America. My responsibility as Secretary for Latin America of the ALC's Division for World Missions and Interchurch Cooperation does not include any responsibility in that part of the world. But because of a sincere interest in Latin America generally, I do reading. I visit with people who have visited Guatemala most directly as one of the countries in Central America. But I'm going to depend today a lot on you and your reading, some of which I'm sure has been in the American press and other contexts that you may have, so that I am not bringing a first-hand report. I'm just not able to do that. But I think we can present some information at the outset which will be helpful to us in our discussion. I remember from last Sunday at our Eucharist the Old Testament text, and knowing what was before me in the teaching sessions this week, the following words from the sixth chapter of Exodus spoke in a very special way. Now I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians have enslaved, and I have remembered my covenant. So tell the Israelites that I say to them, I am the Lord, I will rescue you and set you free from your slavery to the Egyptians. I will raise my mighty arm to bring terrible punishment upon them, and I will save you. I will make you my own people, and I will be your God. You will know that I am the Lord your God when I set you free from slavery in Egypt. This is a theme from the history of the Israelites, which the people of the Christian faith in Central America have made their own. They understand their struggle for the freedom they desire. Most often they understand it in biblical terms. And their suffering and the death of those who are close to them, they also understand as the death which is necessary to bring about the liberation and the freedom from their slavery, this modern-day slavery of oppression and economic, physical poverty. That's a basic assumption that the people of Central America, as many of them followers of Jesus Christ, are facing suffering and death on a daily basis. And they look to the Lord, they look to Jesus Christ, who himself was tortured, suffered and died at the hands of the rulers of the day, as their symbol that they too will see a new day, that there will be a resurrection, that there will be a new life. As I indicated, one of the gifts of the Latin American people to us is that they do not fall easily into the temptation to divide their lives into the spiritual category and the physical existence. The two are bound up very closely into one. And so they would read a text from the Bible and they would be able to to put it into modern, in their present day, everyday categories very easily. Sometimes those of us who are trained in theology would say too quickly. And yet the dangers of not relating the biblical message in our Christian faith to our everyday affairs is a temptation that we fall into very often. And I think we can learn from them. The countries in Central America that we read about in the newspapers that are involved in a struggle, which make headlines, are the countries, primarily the countries of Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And I named these four countries in the order which we find them on the map as we go from north to south. In Central America, starting at the Mexican border, the country to the south of Nicaragua is Costa Rica. Costa Rica has been spared until recently much of the turmoil of Central America. It has a different history. It has a democratic government. The military is not in control, although there have been indications that there too not all is well. But I think if we restrict our attention to these four countries of Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua, we will encounter the basic situation, the basic problem, the reality of Central America. The history of Central America is a history of violence, and someone has pointed out that if the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero in March 1980 were to surprise us, that shows our ignorance of the fact that the first Archbishop of El Salvador, which was assassinated, occurred back in the 16th century. So this is not something new to the people of Latin America. Nor is the civil unrest in El Salvador, for example, something new or which has its roots only in the last decade. A popular uprising in the early 1930s, after many decades of silence and suffering after Indian lands had been taken away from their communities. An uprising in 1932 led to a strong military takeover and a massacre of anywhere from 25 to 32,000 El Salvadorians in that year, almost 50 years ago. And of course, that meant that any kind of opposition for the decades following 1932 was very difficult to find, and the poor, those who are subject to the decisions of the elitist and the ruling oligarchy in El Salvador simply disappeared for these 40 years, and I think we began to take notice of the problem, the armed revolution in El Salvador as recently ago as 5 years. I'm not going to talk about any one country, but we'll be making reference to some things in Guatemala and others in El Salvador and so forth. Many of those who are involved in an opposition to the governments of Central America are indigenous Indian population. Guatemala has a majority of Indian population, and they are largely the rural poor. Guatemala is the largest of these countries that we have mentioned, with around 7 million inhabitants. El Salvador, on the other hand, a smaller country of around 4 million, but confined to an area the size of the state of Massachusetts. I mentioned an oligarchy. The ruling families in El Salvador are named the 14. There really are more than 14 families that comprise the oligarchy, some estimate it to be about 60. But the major decisions for the past years and continue to be in the hands of these families. They are landowners, they are the elite, and they hold the economic power. They have formed an alliance in not only in El Salvador, but in these other countries with the military. Honduras being an exception there, it does not appear that there are there is an oligarchy in charge. But the landowners and the military, through their alliance, have been able to keep the poor from attaining any political influence and political power. And they have kept them largely undernourished and illiterate as well, because an informed electorate, a strong electorate, would be a threat to their power and their status. The church, the Roman Catholic Church, is also a factor, and for many years on the side of the elitist and also the military. And there are still some countries in Latin America where this is the case, in Colombia, which is not really in Central America but in South America, and also in Guatemala, where the archbishop by the name of Mario Casariego is very much aligned with the military government. In El Salvador, the Archbishop Romero martyred in 1980. Although he had been a very conservative bishop, when he became archbishop, almost a transformation occurred. And he began to speak out in a very courageous way against the abuses, and not just minor abuses, but the murders, the assassinations, the torture that took place among the people of his archdiocese. And he was really killed probably because of his appeal in one of his last homilies to the El Salvadorian soldiers to disobey their superiors and to stop killing their fellow countrymen. That is generally regarded as the straw that broke the camel's back, and consequently, within a few days after making this appeal in one of his homilies, he was murdered while celebrating Mass. He is, of course, not the only martyr in Central America. You will recall the murder of four American churchwomen in El Salvador, the murder of which remains unsolved, or it's been solved and it's just not expedient to reveal the details. An American priest just last month, or 2 months ago, was assassinated in Guatemala. Reverend Rother from Oklahoma, pointing out that it isn't only El Salvador, but Guatemala at the present time seems to have a higher level of violence than even El Salvador. And then there are the anonymous martyrs, the peasants, the campesinos, the Indians in Guatemala, by the thousands. In El Salvador, you can use a rough statistic of about 1,000 deaths a month. In Guatemala, it has not reached that yet, but it has been increasing, so it will quite soon pass the figure of 1,000 per month. And unfortunately, the violence in Central America is brutal. It includes mutilation, torture, and the murder of men, women, and children. Before the eyes of the loved ones, in the middle of the night, a reign of terror has taken over. And from all reports, is pervasive and extends to all parts of the country. There are certain parts of the country which have resisted by control of one group or another, have managed to minimize the terror. The terror has its origins according to whom you would ask, either on the extreme right or the extreme left. Most acknowledge that the extreme right is responsible for more of the terrorism. In Guatemala, unfortunately, they have singled out as the victims the center and the moderates, hoping therefore to force the great power of the North, namely the United States, to choose between the far right or the far left as far as where it's going as concerning its support. And so the center and the moderate forces, those speaking for reconciliation, are the ones who have suffered the most in Guatemala. Now I just barely touched on the role of the United States in all this. I think you know that we have been involved in the politics of Central America for decades, and most recently has come to our attention the military aid that we provide to some of these governments, the economic aid. Is it right? Is it wrong? And those are issues which we need to have before us constantly, because I think we are all in agreement that we would like the policy of the United States government to reflect where we are as a people. And we would like this policy to be based on the principles that we base our own society on. Let me just mention about when in connection with the right and the left and the center, I was at a congress in Bogota in August of 1980 where Latin American Lutherans gathered from all over the continent, and we heard a firsthand report from some Lutheran pastors in Central America. And one of those pastors told us that the situation had reached the point where the work of the church, which has preached the gospel of reconciliation, has become subversive. And that to preach reconciliation in its full implication between God and mankind and between brothers and sisters is to be marked for death. That is the point at which the gospel of Christ is interpreted, is seen by the opponents of the different groups in Central America. To preach reconciliation in a clear and articulate way is to risk certain death. And for a pastor to be involved in the daily life of his congregation, go out, make visitation, to be with them in their suffering, is also to risk death. And he said, frankly, that when he leaves in the morning to go out and visit his parishioners, he is not sure, he's not at all certain, that he will return alive to his family. This was a personal, firsthand witness from a Lutheran pastor in Guatemala. And another Catholic priest was quoted in an article in Sojourners magazine as saying, "Today it is subversive to have a Bible in El Salvador. It is subversive to have a Bible, and people hide their Bibles when they are being raided, when they are being visited by the military or the paramilitary groups. And prayer groups and prayer meetings are suspect because it brings people together and there is suspicion on what is going on." That is another reason why I pointed out earlier that the suffering in Central America is interpreted by the people as a suffering for their Christian faith, and those who die as being Christian martyrs. Now, I was asked a question in a forum on Central America about those who are doing the killing or who are the oppressors. How do they see their Christian faith? Well, I must report that they too see themselves as Christians. They would be doing their Christian duty to eliminate the opposition. They would probably be faithful in attendance at church and at mass. And so it becomes a difficult question to answer. But I suppose that is not unique in the history of Christianity, that both the oppressed and the oppressors have appealed to their faith as a rationale for their actions. You will remember the revolution in Nicaragua, which ended in 1979 with an overthrow of the Somoza regime. This revolution in the middle of Central America, of course, has become a symbol of resistance for those other groups in other countries, which would really like to do the same thing, establish a government of the people, eliminate the families or the dictators or the military which rule them now in a very ruthless way, and establish peace. And whether this revolution will be repeated is yet not clear, although in El Salvador it seems not to be the case, in Guatemala even less so at the present time. But that revolution of Nicaragua, together with the martyrdom of Archbishop Romero almost a year later, have become two of the main symbols of the resistance. The Roman Catholic Church, as I mentioned, is somewhat divided in its support of this social and armed revolution. There are, of course, many in the Roman Catholic Church who oppose an armed resistance and a violent overthrow. There are certainly those who would, especially in Nicaragua, who accepted that as being necessary. There are efforts among the peace and justice and nonviolent groups in Latin America to find a different kind of a solution, although there have been no breakthroughs. The winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, the Roman Catholic layperson from Argentina, Adolfo Perez Esquivel, is working tirelessly to find an opening for how a nonviolent solution might be achieved in El Salvador. I wrote here, is violence the only solution in Central America? And one of the answers I think that can be given is that it does appear that the previous violence and destruction in the long history of these countries, elimination, overthrow of modern democratic governments and solutions, reform efforts, seem to indicate that possibly violence is going to be the way that peace returns, that the solution of the problem in Central America is achieved. I guess I would subscribe to the pessimistic view in that case, that not because of the situation today, but because of the way that all reform movements and all social questions have been suppressed in the past, that it would be unlikely that a nonviolent solution would now become possible. Let me just close my introductory statement by quoting from a statement from the third Bishops' Conference, Latin American Bishops in Puebla, which is today often quoted in Central America in the midst of the poverty and the torture and the assassination. Quote, "Jesus well knows what today is so often silenced in Latin America, that pain must be liberated through pain. This means taking up the cross and converting it to the source of a paschal life." Words from Puebla. Puebla had not spoken in a very clear way to the situation in Central America. Many thought it should have spoken more courageously. Yet this quote is very pertinent as we consider the tragedy, the violence, the suffering, the death. And a tendency to the lack of hope that a solution is at hand. Let me then just conclude this part and ask if there are some questions.
I'd touch on, if you will, how much impact as the international communist movement played in this role of the peasants, or whichever side? And
well,
how do we look at it as from our government?
Yeah. The communist involvement in Central America is has been there for decades. I think the revolution in El Salvador in 1932 had communist participation, the one that led to the massacre of about 30,000 Salvadorians. And it certainly is clear to me that in the kind of situation in which the mass of the population of Central America find themselves, the promises of communism would be appealing. And that socialism, even of a Marxist character, certainly is able to find a lot of sympathizers. In Nicaragua, this is, has been the case, and we debate today just how strong is the Marxist tilt of the Nicaraguan government. But it's interesting if you read the platforms of the resistance movements, especially in El Salvador, although they may read very much like a revolutionary-minded communist resistance, they are very firm in declaring that they do not want to be pawns in the conflict between East and West, and that the first one of the first pronouncements and steps they would take if they came to power were to be aligned with the to be a part of the movement of non-aligned countries. And they are tired of I think being subjected to somebody else making the decisions for them. And I would believe that at least their intention would be to become independent and free of whatever exterior influence, including that communism. Certainly there would be also those who are part of this resistance who are avowed communists. I don't suppose that we would expect it to be otherwise. Question over here.
Yes. You mentioned to be in favor of reconciliation was to risk death. Are you talking about just reconciliation in general, putting the parts of society back together, or are you referring to something called the Fellowship of Reconciliation? Did that involve that?
Well, the word was that I heard to preach reconciliation. And I understood that to mean to preach reconciliation as we understand it in our Christian faith, where the basic separation caused by sin and evil in this world separates mankind from the Creator and separates us from one another and creates hate and violence and the like. And so I understood him to say that any preaching of the Christian gospel which would try to break down those barriers which separate us and to bring us into the proper relationship between ourselves and God and between our brothers and sisters would be then a sign to someone that this person should be eliminated. The use of assassination and murder are more from the right than from the left. No one denies that the left is also involved in it, but some would like to say that 90% from the right, 10% from the left, and the others would like to turn it around. I guess I don't know, and I don't know if anybody does.
We attended about a month ago a workshop presented by a representative from the Archdiocese of Seattle who had some first-hand experience in El Salvador. And the thing that became apparent based on that presentation is, first of all, the military is in complete control, but the families who historically have been in control are no longer, because the military has created its own class in society, and through graft and corruption and oppression of the people, that's their source of livelihood, and therefore they're not willing to give that up. The second point is that it's primarily an internal conflict between the poor and the military, and that by our position that we're taking as a country, you know, I mean, without a question, we're continuing to aid that oppression. I mean, the point is those people are poor and they're struggling for land rights and struggling for the basic principles that we affirm in this country, yet through our military and economic assistance to the junta, we're continuing in their oppression. And I'd be interested in your comments about our foreign policy and why we can't affirm the same rights in Latin America that we affirm in the United States.
Well, the policy over against El Salvador at the present time is one which tries to take a middle road, tries to create at least a case of supporting centrist policies in El Salvador, saying that to support the present government of El Salvador is not to support the extreme right, but to support the only credible force and hope that the government, that the country can get back on an even keel and can save itself. That's the avowed policy of our government in El Salvador. We are not defending the rightists. Now, the criticism to that policy says, you're mistaken. The government that you think is centrist is not centrist, and you're being deluded, and that you cannot obtain the objectives, the U.S. could not obtain the objectives that it wants to obtain because it's starting from a false premise. It is true that there are, that the U.S. government has some evidence for the fact that the government in El Salvador is attempting a middle of the road policy. But critics say that it's too little, too late. That it was kind of a patched up centrist government that really doesn't have any support at all. In other words, it covers up a vacuum, and there really are no supporters of that. And that may be true. In Guatemala, I think it wasn't true before, by the selective killing that's going on of the centrist forces, it is rapidly becoming the case that there is no center. And so if somebody came now well, there's an article I have here of one political leader in Guatemala who maintains that there is still a hope to establish a centrist government, and he wants to participate in the 1982 elections. Now, almost all of the recent elections in Guatemala have been falsified, and so there are many who say it's ridiculous. He'll never be able to get elected anyway. We have supported the government in Guatemala, which does not purport to be a centrist government, and General Garcia is universally regarded as one of the strongest and most rightist military dictatorship in Central America. Our policy of providing military and economic aid to El Salvador then is to keep that government alive, because if without our aid and government, it cannot effect the kind of reforms that it says are necessary and that is attempting to do, such as agrarian reform. Again, on the books, the agrarian reform law in El Salvador is very fine. It even surpasses some of the agrarian reform measures taken in Nicaragua. But of the three phases of it, only the first phase has really gotten anywhere. And some would say that this is only scratching the surface. Now, as far as your comment that the 14 families or the oligarchy is no longer in control, I certainly think they have abdicated their political control, but I do not think that they have departed, they have been forced out from their economic control. And I would say that that there's still a lot of influence from the elitist that are not military. As a matter of fact, in El Salvador specifically, there seems to be now that the present government is trying to make an alliance with the business community, recognizing that you can't run a government if you devote all your attention to the battles and the war and the violence, and they want to establish some kind of an economic base.
Yeah, I'm really not able to speak to that. I know that in Latin America, the Marxist Christian concept is a viable one, and you will find Christians who will say that they are Marxists. But I have not had the acquaintance. There's a book written, Marxism and Christianity, by José Miguel Bonino, a Protestant theologian in Argentina, who speaks directly to this question. I'm not able to say, except that I think you're right. Those who, especially in Latin America, who find many attractive things about Marxism do not always go the way of the atheistic Marxism, and they hang on to their Christian faith. And maybe they like to use the word Marxism because of the way they interpret it, and because of some of the influence that it might gain them. But I believe you're right that Latin America is a place where that has become more than a rarity, and I won't necessarily say commonplace, but it's increasingly so around the continent. Marxism and Christianity. I can give you the exact publisher and so on after the session. I have the bibliographical reference with me. Yes, sir. Well, many would say that to think that we can bring about a peaceful solution by injecting more arms or support for military involvement is contradictory. And then the other position says, but if you buoy up and build up a centrist government, then that centrist government will be strong enough to, you know, and will gather appeal from both sides, and slowly the violence will diminish. Those are the truth. Well, I can give you my opinion. I guess I side with the group of American church persons who visited Guatemala just recently, and who called on the U.S. government to take the side of those in those societies who are seeking the same expression and the same freedoms that we've always considered vital and precious in the United States. And if we read from the Declaration of Independence here and think Central America, it just about blows your mind, because we too, at a certain point, declared that when a government was oppressive and did not permit its people to exercise freedom, that it should be overthrown. Barring that, which I don't consider likely, I would then again side with these church persons who said, let us at least stay out of it, so that we cannot become a factor for the deciding their solution. That's where I guess I am. To those who argue that, well, we can't stay out because we know the Soviet Union won't. Well, if we are concerned, you know, about the interjection of arms, I think we can legitimately be concerned about Soviet arms going into these countries. But we have to start at home. We have to start with our own arms. And then it seems that we gain credibility in the world community, and perhaps some influence, so that we can stop whatever arms are being moved into the area. But we can't do that, it seems to me, only on the basis of saying, well, they're putting in more arms than we are, therefore theirs are wrong and ours are okay. That would be my answer. Another question? The people of the nations of Latin America, it seems to me, just are desperately in search of something that doesn't have to be either Soviet or Chinese communism and American capitalism. They are mistrustful of both, and they sincerely believe that if they're given the freedom and the chance to do so, they can come up with an alternative solution. And that's what Don Helder Camara says in the film Excuse Me, America, and he's not a lone voice by any means. It's true. They are having a difficulty. They still have two priests in the cabinet, even though the Pope indicated that they should get out. They made an exception by saying, well, at least don't exercise your priestly functions while you're in politics. And now our congressman from Massachusetts had to give up his seat, and he listened to the Pope, but these two priests in Nicaragua continue to be on the government. Differences of ideology seem to have indicated, it seem to have been the cause for a couple of cabinet members to leave even the country, which is reason to wonder what's going on. And yet people who visit Nicaragua have not brought back any reports that there is repression of a violent nature. There is some censorship that continues to be in existence. But they are, of course, they're a very crucial point on a teeter-totter. They would like to have their own freedom, and yet if the U.S. turns their back on them, I suppose their tendency is to go where they know they can get some aid from the communist bloc, and there are certainly those in their government who would be quick to bring up that. No, they would call themselves a popular military government. The revolution was run by people who were not military, but they've gained a lot of military experience in their long struggle to overthrow Somoza. And so, you know, call them paramilitary, but those who are in charge in Nicaragua have definitely been on the battlefield. If that's it. Honduras is a nation where even the rich are poor, as someone said. And in view of the fall of the Somoza, strong man, Somoza in Nicaragua, the U.S. Government has kind of looked to Honduras maybe to pick up a role of kind of a police officer in Central America, and has, because they have elections, and they don't have at the present time the civil unrest and violence as in the other countries. They have been providing some refuge for Somoza's followers from Nicaragua, which is their bordering country, and they have been accused of forcing back Salvadorian refugees into El Salvador, where they then were massacred. So they're not clean. Their elections are yet not very definite. The president of Honduras at the present time is politely referred to as having a drinking problem. It's really not a stable government, and yet it seems to have been chosen by the United States as a possibility to establish a beachhead again where U.S. influence can continue to be strong. As I said earlier, there never has been really a strong oligarchy in Honduras. But the coffee barons and the fruit companies seem to have their control of Honduras. It's the first of the so-called banana republics, and that's about what I know about it in a nutshell. I think so. There are no other questions at the present time. So, well, one more question: the methods as well as the ideology, especially the national security doctrine, are definitely find their origin in the relationship that we've had with Latin American countries. We see the problem, east and west, and the Europeans don't always buy that. As you know, both Mexico and France have now recognized the revolutionary forces in El Salvador as the legitimate government of the El Salvadorian people. And that was certainly over our protests and against the best plans of our foreign policy. A European journalist said, and I'll just close with this, and then we'll go to Argentina, said to kind of a question to the United States generally, can you not see that hunger and oppression are the real root of the problem? And if you sincerely desire a solution and desire peace on your southern borders, how can you continue to ignore that? Well, we don't want to cut off the discussion, but I did promise another that I could take a question on Argentina. So, Peter. Argentina went through a terrible period in the 70s with the disappearance of opposition leaders and students and torture and murder and, in one of the most civilized and economically most developed countries in South America, to have that happen, of course, was an embarrassment to the Argentinian people and to many. I think things have loosened a little bit. There certainly is harassment going on, but the level of harassment has diminished. I don't think it's true that, how did you say that there are no political dissenters because they're all dead or something like that? That's probably true in Guatemala, that there are no political prisoners because there are only political murders. I don't think it's true in Argentina, in my understanding. I know a few Argentinians, and I know that they oppose their own government, and they may live in some fear, but they have not. They do not now fear being kidnapped, tortured, and murdered, as was the case back in the 70s. There has been that improvement. There has been an improvement in Brazil in that regard since 1971. Very definitely was a strong factor in Latin America, and a lot of the people in Latin America who are on the side of the oppressors and the right were delighted, that Carter was defeated. And there were some initial signals from the Reagan administration which would have seemed to wipe out all of the advances in linking up, support for governments with human rights care and concern. And although Reagan is sending out a few different signals now, a little bit backtracking towards where Carter had taken the policy, those initial signals with sending of General Walters down to El Salvador and a few things caused many people to fear that even the hint of a change in policy was being translated into the death of people in those countries as the people in control gained new courage. Well, now we're free of him and we'll be back to business as usual. Carter himself didn't come across initially as a great savior for Latin American people. But at the time he was defeated, there was a general, mourning that a courageous voice to their governments in this regard had been. Yes, they do. We could call it hypocritical. They would call themselves devoted, pious Roman Catholic families. But I don't think that's to be too surprising. I think there have always been people who have hidden behind, the name of Christianity to work evil in this world. We're going to speak more about this on Friday when we talk about love or lovelessness. This is a theme that I picked up from a Brazilian pastor who wrote a paper, and he doesn't claim to be a liberation theologian, but I think we can learn just on the grassroots how liberation theology works itself out in practice and in the Latin American context. And we'll return to that, how in the name of Christianity atrocities have been committed around the world, but in Latin America specifically so.